You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at a changing of the political guard in Latin America and what it can mean for the influence and relationship with the United States in the region. Now, on our last week of Pride Month, we take a look back at the history of drag here in Wisconsin. Our guest traces that history going back to the 1880s, with performances sometimes seen as seedy, even illegal, and in some eras as family-friendly entertainment. Michael Takash is a historian and co-host of the podcast Be Seen. He recently wrote an article for 88.9 Radio Milwaukee called Tracing the Roots of Wisconsin's Drag History Dating Back to the 1880s. He's the co-author of the book The History of Milwaukee Drag that's out today. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, it might seem surprising to a lot of people that the history of drag and drag performances goes back as far as it does. Do you get that surprised reaction often?
All the time. People think that the mainstreaming of drag has happened just since the launch of Drag Race in 2009, when in fact it's been much embedded in the culture and entertainment of Wisconsin for over 100 years prior.
Now, take us to the 1880s and this first recorded, you know, what we might think of as a drag show, I guess, in Wisconsin. What was that like?
Well, you have to understand that at the time, female impersonators were not on stages. They were not seen as entertainment in most cities. But the arrival of Francis Leon, who was billed as the only Leon because he had been so popular and famous from coast to coast and even to Australia that he inspired a legion of impersonators on his own. When he took the stage in Milwaukee, it was seen as a sign that the city was maturing culturally and that it was really becoming a place that attracted the arts and culture scene of larger cities. At the time, Milwaukee didn't have a city hall like it does now. It didn't have the Pabst Theater like it does now. City Hall Square was really a muddy, dirty intersection without paved streets, without public sewers, without indoor plumbing, without electric lighting. It was a very, very different place. So the arrival of this opera hall and, of course, of Francis Leon really was something special. And the Milwaukee Sentinel commented the next morning that that Leon could make a fool of a man if he didn't know it was a man. And most in the audience swore it was not a man, which is kind of hilarious in retrospect.
What made you want to share the history of drag performances and female impersonators in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee in particular?
Well, as a historian, it's really, you know, it's kind of an unexplored territory. And I mean, while I've done work on LGBTQ history, I've heard so many stories from contributors to the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project and from friends and acquaintances about what was called the Golden Age of Drag, which was this period from about 1981 to 1991, when drag shows in Milwaukee were so fiercely locked in competition that, I mean, production standards, talent, you know, the experience of going to a show were all through the roof. The cast were really treated as celebrities all over the state and traveled around the country performing. I mean, it was really a very unusual time. And, you know, hearing about this really inspired the book. And originally, we were just going to focus on that 10-year period. But upon doing more research and kind of looking back, you know, through the decades, it really became obvious that there's been about 7 generations of drag in Milwaukee. And, you know, it's been continuous. Whereas in other major cities of the world, drag was outlawed. It was banned. It was actually forbidden by law to perform in female attire or male attire if you were genetically female. So even that in itself is historically significant, but the stories and the progression and just this unfolding chronicle, this unfolding timeline, is just really a fascinating story, even without the performers or the performances added on.
Yeah, as you share the timeline, it's really, there's this back and forth over the years in Milwaukee, and I'm guessing elsewhere, where this people viewed it as depraved, as you mentioned, maybe even outlawed it, to this is wholesome fun for the whole family. And I don't think I'm exaggerating, right?
No, you're not. No, I mean, prior to Francis Leon's arrival in Milwaukee in 1884, female impersonators existed, but they were seen only in what was called dime museums, which were kind of like a P.T. Barnum stationary circus rather than a traveling circus, where you could go and see all kinds of genetic curiosities under one roof for the price of a dime. And, you know, the female impersonator was seen as something like unusual, a curiosity, not a performer and not an artist, but just kind of like a, almost like, sad to say, almost like a freak show. And Francis Leon and his contemporaries really took that out of the Dime Museum and put them on stages, which continued through the vaudeville years. And by 1910, you know, the rise of national drag celebrities like Bert Savoy and Carl Norman and Julian Eltinge really changed, like, the whole concept of female impersonation. I mean, it was completely family friendly to go to an Orpheum vaudeville show with your, you know, your grandmother in the 19-teens and 1920s, simply because everyone knew it was a man pretending to be a woman, and the joke was, you know, not on the audience. There was no deception. There was no depravity. But over the years, that offstage, onstage separation kind of wore thin, and people started to feel that there was something wrong with female impersonators, that they would choose this life and this art. And, you know, some of the narrative we even see today politically is not new. It's pulled from those eras where drag was targeted as kind of like degenerate.
I wanted to ask you as we wrap up about today. I mean, we've got some people definitely viewing some kind of like drag show, drag performer readings as appropriate, family-friendly, kid-friendly fare. We have legislation in Florida advanced that would maybe take away kids from parents who brought their kids to a drag show. People showing up to protest just in the news in the last couple days with open firearms against a drag queen story hour. Both of those threads, the family-friendly view, the depravity view, really colliding these days.
Right. And I think I would really question, what does the child see? I mean, for a child in a drag queen story hour, they see somebody who's colorfully dressed, who's kind and gentle to them, reading them a story in kind of an adventurous way. I don't think they see depravity. I don't think they see a degenerate. They see someone interestingly dressed who maybe is not, you know, how anyone in their family or any of their friends dress. And that's the attraction. It's kind of that glamour. It's the art. It's the design. It's the costume. It's the experience. Certainly there are shows that are not for children. They are not happening in public libraries. They're happening at, you know, cabarets that are ticketed and adults only after, you know, a certain hour. But then there are also family-friendly, you know, brunches and dinners at places like Hamburger Mary's in Milwaukee, where, you know, the audience is well aware that they're not getting an X-rated show. And perhaps because of that, it's safe to bring their mom or their niece or their children. I think that it's a huge mistake to start targeting a legitimate form of entertainment that's been with us for, you know, seven generations, simply based on the morals of a snapshot in time.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Michael Takash, author, historian, co-host of the podcast Be Seen. His new book, co-authored, is The History of Milwaukee Drag. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a new poem from a Milwaukee writer.
Finding forgiveness is deeply personal. Sometimes it's easy to forgive someone who's wronged you and move on. Other times, the road to forgiveness is long and bumpy. But what if forgiveness isn't an option? Writer Deshaun McKinney of Milwaukee is exploring this in his new collection of poetry, Father Forgive Me. He shares one poem from that book on forgiveness.
Somewhere you read forgiveness and dreamt about killing a man. You hear forgiveness unburdens and check that the knife is still by your pillow. Sometimes you feel sorry and remember your father's words, how you suck in your stomach in mirrorless rooms and take pride in no one believing you were ever that big in your resurrection. You tell yourself that you are a man now, but every night, write a hymn for the boy who tried to scrub his stretch marks into oblivion. You think of what he would have been if worshipped, if celebrated instead of sacrifice, wonder what to set upon an altar for sensitive black boys. Regret the threat of the knife, but polish the metal, reset it anyway, having learned young that sensitive black boys were fighters of the world's accord. Learned young that you would have to unlearn your tears, but learn how to store them for one day. You remind yourself that it's never too late to get an education. Hope one day is less tomorrows away when you awake. Next to the blade will be a letter addressed to black women, handwritten, for fixing you plates of collard greens and pig's feet as large as the table, calling you baby and weighing your report cards heavier than the digits on any bathroom, hallway, living room scale. You tell yourself you are a man now. That you say I love you to the homies without context and hope it sounds as soft as you believe love needs to be. On the most tender nights, you scroll through memories of smiles, hugs, travels, and sex to preempt the dreams. You wake to the stillness of 4 a.m., having read about forgiveness somewhere, and forgive yourself for having trouble finding it.
That's writer Deshaun McKinney reading his poem on forgiveness. He explains the inspiration behind that piece.
This poem was really coming from a space of just thinking about the idea of forgiveness. You know, so often when we experience some kind of hardship or trauma or betrayal or whatever it is, we're often told that forgiveness is the path to move forward. And like, it's almost as if that's what you have to do or you're supposed to do. And that's the only way to heal from something. I think of it as an interesting idea of, well, it's never that simple. And I think we so often force people into it that that idea of me having to forgive can also be harmful in some ways. And I'm of the mind that that's not necessarily the only way to move forward. So for me, when I was writing this poem, I really wanted to just kind of grapple with the complexity. What does it look like when you hear these things, I should forgive, or I read about forgiveness as the poem says, and I'm actually having trouble getting to that point of forgiveness? And just kind of what does that look like?
McKinney's poem is part of a greater collection of his work called Father Forgive Me.
The book is called Father Forgive Me, and it's really a book that grapples with and nuances generational traumas. And it's really figuring out how does it affect you? How does it follow you through your life? I want to present different time periods and different scenarios of how it impacts you, and then wants to grapple with that idea of forgiveness, and which really pairs down to what do you do with these experiences and this trauma, and how do you move forward? And so it's these poems all have that through line of that journey of you experience this thing that is very impactful on your life and you're carrying this weight, and then how do you move through the world and where do you go next? And really about how do you live with things that have been imposed upon you? I think that's kind of what I hope to get across with this book.
Writer Deshaun McKinney is from Milwaukee. He recently released a new collection of poetry called Father Forgive Me through Black Sunflowers Poetry Press. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the recent first ever election of a leftist presidential ticket in the country of Colombia has raised questions about the future of American influence there and around Latin America. Our guest breaks down what it all means for the U.S. and our foreign policy. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. In an election just over a week ago, Colombian voters elected a leftist president for the first time. Gustavo Petro and his running mate Francia Marquez, the country's first black vice president, represent a trend of countries in Latin America turning to more left-leaning leadership, including Peru and Chile. What does it mean for the U.S., which has for a long time had relationships with more conservative governments in the region? Cynthia J. Arnson is a distinguished fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin America program. She's an expert on Latin American politics. Cindy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with Colombia. How big a turn was this election outcome in that country just a week ago?
It's really a huge turn, and it's, I think, because it represented not only the election of Gustavo Petro, but also the person that he was running against in the second round, a huge sea change. When traditional elites were rejected outright, and Gustavo Petro is a man of the left, Colombia has never had a leftist president. We can talk later about why that is, but the person he was running against in the second round was also someone who was a virtual unknown on the national stage until he captured the public imagination by campaigning on an anti-corruption platform and mostly campaigning through TikTok. And he overtook the establishment candidate in the second round. And that was also, I think, unheard of in Colombian politics.
People hear left-leaning candidates winning in Latin America and might think of, you know, somebody who fits into a European or American mold of the left, or an authoritarian left-leaning populist leader like in Venezuela. The same could be said on the right, right of center or right-wing authoritarian. What do you see these Colombia and those other countries I mentioned? What direction do you see those heading?
Well, I think the major trend is not so much to the left, although the presidents that you just mentioned are men of the left. It's more a rejection of the current government. So in the case of Chile, which had a center-right government, the Chilean public, because it has suffered so many reversals during the COVID-19 pandemic, this is a region that has just been, you know, they had the worst economic performance of any developing area, more COVID deaths than any part per capita than any other part of the world. People are punishing the incumbents. So if the incumbent was someone of the center right, they go to someone of the center left or the left. The same in Colombia. You had a center right government now being rejected, and you have a leftist government coming into place. And we're going to see the largest country of South America, Brazil, have a presidential election this coming October. And the expectation is that a right-wing president, Bolsonaro, will be replaced by a leftist. Lula, the former president, is likely to come back. So right now, the trend seems to be towards the left, but mostly I think it's a trend that says, you know, the current government hasn't delivered what we need. Get rid of them and bring in an alternative.
I think the United States for a long time has viewed Latin America as kind of our backyard, for better or worse, maintained a lot of influence in the some of the countries we're talking about. Does the U.S. matter so much in these countries that have turned to center-left or left leaders?
The United States continues to matter to certain countries, but there has been, and this was certainly on display as the United States hosted the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles just a couple of weeks ago, that countries feel at much greater liberty to defy the United States and to reject U.S. influence. And it's certainly been the case for at least the last 15 years or so that the large commodity exporting countries of South America have turned to China as their principal export destination, their principal trading partner. They've also had, you know, billions of dollars of Chinese loans and infrastructure investments. And the United States is really not able to match that. But the what I think has been really notable is that even countries that traditionally have depended very heavily on U.S. foreign assistance, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, felt at liberty to not show up to the summit to protest what they said was, you know, a U.S. decision to not invite the authoritarian governments of Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. And I think that's what's unheard of. You know, the United States needs the cooperation of those governments to stem migration. The Biden administration has also lashed out against not only government officials, but members of the private sector for being involved in corruption. So, you know, it reportedly, you know, some of those presidents wouldn't even take a phone call from Secretary of State Tony Blinken. So we're, I think, in a very different very different moment from, say, 20 years ago when the first Summit of the Americas was held, and the region was overwhelmingly democratic, and with the exception of Cuba, and U.S. leadership was unquestioned at the end of the Cold War and the advent of a unipolar world. And I think that's really changed.
With the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a lot of international economic issues, conflict with China economically and more, Latin America doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention. And you were quoted in a Washington Post piece saying that's bad. What are you hoping to see, especially from the U.S. administration when it comes to Latin America?
Well, one thing I think that would be an important step forward is to confirm ambassadors. There are many major Latin American countries that haven't had an ambassador for some time. Chile, for example, 3.5 years. The career foreign service ambassador, career diplomat, Philip Goldberg, recently left Colombia. And there is a chargé d'affaires. And I think it really hurts U.S. diplomacy. And this is not only the fault of the administration or the responsibility of the administration. There are people on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that are holding up a number of these ambassadorial appointments because they are not happy either with the nominee or with some other aspect of Biden foreign policy. And that really hurts, I think, U.S. diplomacy overall, and hurts the U.S. relationship with the region. But just as important as the diplomacy is to partner or to build a coalition with all of the regional development banks, with the Inter-American Development Bank, the World Bank, the Development Bank of Latin America, known as the CAF, to have all of these banks come together with the United States, with the Development Finance Corporation, and really start to foster investment in countries that are on their knees economically. And the United States so far has not showed that it has much to deliver. And Biden was not terribly bold at the Summit of the Americas in terms of announcing a new initiative. That was, in my view, a real lost opportunity.
And we'll leave it there. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
That's Cynthia Arntzen, Distinguished Fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program, looking at recent trends in Latin American elections, what it means for the United States. Tomorrow here on Central Time, we're feeling the impacts of climate change, but a guest says there's still time to change things. We'll hear the case for spreading climate hope. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we explore the growing differences between states in the U.S. and why our guest is comparing modern divides to the times of the Articles of Confederation back before we had a constitution. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, what it means for states, and the precedent it could set for future Supreme Court decisions. First, for many Americans, the United States don't feel very united right now. State governments are passing conflicting laws on abortion, gender and sexuality, guns, and a lot of the other most polarizing issues facing the country. Our next guest says it harkens back to another time in U.S. history before the Constitution was even in place, when the original states that fought in the Revolutionary War were governed by the Articles of Confederation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the differences we're seeing in state laws and policy? Do you see a growing divide between red states and blue states? And where does a state like Wisconsin fit into all of that? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Donald Kettle is a professor emeritus and former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's a former professor at UW-Madison, and he's the author of the book The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. He wrote a recent column for governing.com called Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it is good to be with you and with all my friends there in Wisconsin.
I know you've been thinking about federalism and divisions among states a lot in recent years. What led to this column and looking all the way back to the Articles of Confederation?
You know, I was thinking about where we are and where we seem to be going when it comes to dividing power between Washington and the states, and actually wrote this before Roe v. Wade decision came out from the court last week. And was concerned, though, more broadly about whether or not there's really anything that is truly a national issue these days. Is there anything that we all agree on that we want for the government to do on behalf of all of us, regardless of where we live? And it seemed to me that the answer to that question is getting harder and harder to come by. And it's set up even more by the decision last week by the court, for sure.
Remind us, take us back to the era of the Articles of Confederation that ultimately frustrated people enough that they wrote the Constitution.
Yeah, it's such an amazing story, and it's one that, for the most part, we've forgotten in the course of history since. But after the colonies declared independence from Great Britain, the big question was, okay, now how are they going to govern themselves? And one of the things that happened as we look back over what happened in those days was that the Continental Congress was established and it met in Philadelphia. They decided that they had to have something to be able to govern themselves by. They had a big concern about the one thing they did not want to do is to make sure that they had a king or some kind of ruler as powerful as the king that they were fighting to overthrow. And so they established a system of government called the Articles of Confederation. And it was a loose confederation for sure, with the states still in charge of what was happening. And it took actually 3/4 of the states to get any work done. The big problem was that it got to be hard to get even enough states to show up to vote on anything to be able to get things done. And so we managed to fight and win the Revolutionary War using this, but it didn't last very long afterwards. And it was clear we needed to do something to try to replace it.
The Constitution is what replaced it. It gave more power to the federal government, but not all power. And I know, Don, over the years, from various parties at different times, there's a concern that too much power ended up flowing up to the federal government, and that for one reason or another, maybe it should be pushed back to restored to the states. Where do you see that trend going today?
No, it's the great fundamental issue about American government that is at the core of so much of what we did. It's at the core of what happened with the Civil War. It's the core of what happened with the civil rights battles. It's clear, I think, now that what we see is a strong concern that the federal government, on the part of at least a lot of Americans, has seized too much power with an interest of pushing more of that power back to the states. We saw that in the case of COVID. We saw that in the case of environmental policy and other kinds of issues. But on the other hand, people on the left are concerned that, left to their own devices, the states would push these decisions in the wrong direction and undermine the unity that the United States of America was really aimed at accomplishing. So what we have now, at the very least, is a kind of battle over these issues unlike anything we've seen in at least the last generation. And it's really leading to some deep fractures among the states about the question of where the dividing lines between the federal government and the states ought to be. And a related question, I guess, how much division among the states are we prepared to tolerate? To what degree should the states be able to go in completely different directions? That sets itself up for the big debate now on abortion, but it goes back to the issues of COVID and to just about everything else that's fundamental. The big question here at the core is, what are those things that really ought to be national policy, and who ought to decide that? How much power should we allow to the states to try to sort that out in the meantime?
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Maryland, formerly from the UW-Madison, looking at dividing lines in American politics by party over issues. One state looks more or less and less like another state in many cases, blue state versus red state, as they move farther apart on issues. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. How much should states be able to go on their own to decide important issues? How much authority should the federal government have over them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Don, what do you see driving these really stark divides on so many issues?
In some ways, it's some of the same kind of divides that we've seen throughout American history, and even back to the old days of the Articles of Confederation, and then the days that's really passed that by as we tried to write a Constitution of the United States. What's happening now is grave concern that decisions being made in Washington don't match the views of at least some people in some states, and they're calling for more state power to be able to pull the power back to state capitals and use that to prevent the national government, the federal government, from imposing its will on the states along the way. We've seen that back and forth. We fought a civil war over those issues, of course. We had big battles over the issues of civil rights and civil liberties. we had a time when it seemed in the 1960s where we were moving past some of those divisions, but no sooner did it seem clear that those divisions were going past that we began to see big differences popping up again. Things like Medicaid and differences in healthcare. We've seen it in COVID most recently, and now we've seen it on some of these social policy issues that have to do with the core fundamental battles over issues having to do with abortion in particular now.
We're talking to Don Kettle from the University of Maryland, looking at divisions between states in the United States. In a recent piece, he says it's starting to look like the pre-Constitution days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see driving these divisions? Do you see ways to bridge them? What are your hopes? What are your fears? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Don Kettle, formerly with UW-Madison, now emeritus professor at University of Maryland. He wrote a recent column about divisions in the United States for governing.com. called Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Samantha is with us in Menominee. Hi, Samantha.
Hi there.
Hi, what did you want to bring up?
I know the conversation usually tends towards federal versus states' rights in situations like with Roe v. Wade, things like gay marriage, and it seems like it's really just a stand-in for progressive or conservative politics that when Roe is the law of the land, then conservatives would prefer to have state rule. But I'm guessing that pretty soon we're going to start seeing movements toward making abortion illegal nationwide by conservatives, because that's what they would ultimately prefer to have. Same thing with when states were deciding gay marriage. It was pushed by progressives ultimately to become the federal law of the land. We would all prefer to have our policies rule the entire nation. And if we can't get that, then we try to have it be states' rights. So it doesn't really feel like there's all that much that divides us as states. It's just whether or not you're winning.
Interesting. Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. The state versus federal argument, a tool, depending on who's making that federal decision, Don. What do you think?
I think that's a great point that Samantha makes, and in particular, the best form of politics is the one where my views win. And so that's the easiest thing to get consensus on. The problem, of course, is that we're dividing ourselves on what it is that we can actually agree on and how we feel about having others make decisions that we don't agree with. It goes deeper, though, I think, than just the winning and the losing, because there are big consequences that flow from the differences among the states. The rate at which children are taken care of, for example, infant mortality, and then by extension, the kind of care provided to their mothers and maternal mortality, that varies dramatically among the states. And so there are big policy differences. The kind of air pollution standards that are kept among the states varies tremendously as well. The death rate from COVID has varied tremendously among the states. And so in part, for sure, when it comes to the politics of who gets to decide is really a question of whether or not I can find ways of making my own values be the ones that win. But on the other hand, there are big policy implications that come along with making decisions in different ways. And one of the big issues, and it's something that I'm working on right now, is to what degree does giving the abortion decision back to the states then create wide disparities in the ways in which children are taken care of? The abortion rights are going to be dramatically different depending on where you live, but so too are the level of health care provided to kids, provided to their mothers, the kind of life expectancies that come out of that. And so there are not only the big fundamental kinds of issues and debates about who it is who ought to get to be able to rule, but also the question of what kind of policy implications flow from that. And it's those implications that are just as important that we need to pay attention to.
Thanks for that call, Samantha. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
I think the founding fathers were right to form a republic rather than a democracy, because an actual democracy, all it amounts to is 51% of the population being able to take away the rights of the remaining 49. Gore Vidal made an interesting observation in his address at the 125th anniversary of the Nation magazine. that occasionally we make the mistake of trying to think there was, or trying to start a third party in this country, making the mistake to think that there was two parties to begin with.
Jim, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for that call. Don, Jim, bring up a point I think the founders were thinking about. We want to make sure a majority doesn't impose its will on a minority. I've seen arguments that in the current system, with leans in the Electoral College, Senate representation, and more, that we may be seeing a minority of Americans control the fate of the majority. What do you think of what our caller had to say and those arguments?
Yeah, exactly. As you know, this is precisely the kinds of things that the founders worried about. One of the reasons why they went from the Articles of Confederation, where we had a government that proved incapable of getting anything done, to a constitution where the primary goal was that the people ought to rule, that there really ought to be a democracy, but that there ought to be a republican form of democracy where we would elect representatives who would make decisions on our behalf. But boy, were they worried about the issues that might come up that could divide the country, that the prospects that a majority might be able to impose its will on the minority, that now, as you suggest, Rob, that we may have the reverse case where a minority of the population may be able to impose its will on a majority because of the way in which the Electoral College is set, by the ways in which, in many cases, state redistricting is defined as well. And so in many ways, the founders would recognize precisely these questions. I doubt that they would have imagined the kind of politics surrounding the issues of abortion or even gun control as we have it now, even though, of course, they debated the Second Amendment. But they sure would understand the underlying issues here, because they're precisely the same kinds of things that they debated and, in fact, fought over when first they wrote the Articles of Confederation and then decided how, through the Constitution, they ought to try to resolve them.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more quick call from Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And I will try to condense my rambling point as much as possible. I was just calling in to say, you know, reflect on how much the country has changed since the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution were written. I mean, we've gone from having fewer than 15 states or colonies to 50 plus territories. We have way more people. The geographic area of the country is massive. You know, an average U.S. state is, you know, the same size as or larger than a
Michael,
lot of
Europe. Michael, I gotcha. We just have a few moments left with you. Don, are we bursting at the seams? Is it time for another fundamental review of how we do this stuff?
Well, you know, the biggest problem is that there's nothing wrong with the problems that we face or the system that we've got that easier problems and more consensus wouldn't solve. As long as we have disputes and differences among ourselves about some of these big things, I don't think there's any system or any kind of structure that could just wipe them away. But we are clearly now entering a new stage where we not only have to try to figure out how to talk with each other, but how to try to govern ourselves collectively and to make sure that our differences don't pull ourselves apart. And this is precisely the kind of thing that the founders worried most about. And it's up to us now to try to carry forward in the kind of traditions and the values that they worked and actually fought so hard to try to establish.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's so great to be with you, Rob.
Donald Kettle is a professor emeritus and former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, formerly with UW-Madison, author of the book The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. He was with us today talking about a recent column he wrote for governing.com. It's called Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? In many states, incarcerated people have copays for health care, but with low income from prison jobs, they sometimes end up choosing between medical services and things like toiletries or phone calls to home. That can impact the health of incarcerated people and their ability to move forward after serving their sentences. Jonah Balekas is a digital content producer at WPR. He's reported about the effects of the copay system inside prisons. WPR's Melissa Ingles talked to him about what he found, including what Wisconsin's policy is and how it changed during the pandemic.
So with some exceptions, Wisconsin charges $7.50 as a copay for a medical visit. So people in prisons can visit the health services unit for all types of reasons, a toothache, chest pains, a broken finger. at the start of the pandemic, the State Department of Corrections suspended medical copays related to COVID-19 or other respiratory symptoms, and that suspension is still in place. But to see how Wisconsin's policy compared nationally, I looked at an analysis from the Prison Policy Initiative, and some states made similar COVID-related suspensions. Some reverted back to their pre-pandemic stance, and 10 states don't charge copays at all, with Illinois and California most recently joining that group.
Interesting. So $7.50 might not seem like a lot of money, but for someone in prison, how much is $7.50?
It's worth keeping in mind how much money people who are incarcerated make from their jobs, whether it's in the kitchen or a laundry unit. People in prisons might only make 10 cents or up to 60 cents per hour.
Wow.
One man I spoke with, Cedric Farley, said 60% of his paycheck went directly to various court costs. That left him making about $8.94 every 2 weeks. And Farley grew up in poverty. He had to be careful with his money. And one medical copay took up nearly 2 weeks worth of work. A 2017 Prison Policy Initiative story estimated how much a minimum wage worker in each state would pay if they were charged at the same rate people in prison are. In Wisconsin, that was about $600. Farley got out of prison about 2 years ago, and he lives in Eau Claire now. He's still paying off court costs, as well as about $200 in medical debt.
Like that perpetuates poverty because it follows you out here into the world. It puts tremendous, you know what I mean? It puts tremendous stress and financial stress on your family as well.
So what kind of decisions did people have to make in prison based on what they could afford?
People in prison without means have to decide between paying for medical care and buying some toiletries or paying for phone calls home. Some felt forced to have injuries or illnesses remain untreated, and that's obviously bad from a health perspective, but it's also true that that can often lead to higher costs for treatment down the road, a cost paid for by people who can't afford it or on the taxpayer-funded prisons. Marianne Olson is the Fox Cities organizer for Expo, which stands for Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. While she had some financial support through her husband, she said she saw other women in prison have to make these kinds of decisions.
That was a difficult, agonizing choice that I don't think anyone in Wisconsin would want their mothers or daughters or sisters having to choose.
Wow, it seems like a lot of trade-offs. I mean, what are the formerly incarcerated people you spoke with think should be done about it?
So I asked everyone what they would like the policy to be. And I certainly had a lot of people say that they don't think there should be medical copays in prisons at all. People applauded the Department of Corrections decision to suspend copays for COVID-19 symptoms. But they also said that that move suggested the department had some latitude to make policy changes. I heard that the suspension should be made permanent since the pandemic might not have a clear end date. I heard about getting rid of copays for so-called COVID-19 long haulers. And I heard that if copays stay the same, wages should go up. I'll add that the department declined to make someone available for an interview. I would have asked them why they have their policy as it is and why they would or would not consider any changes.
All right. So that article available at WPR.org. Jonah Belekas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's WPR's Jonah Belekas talking to WPR's Melissa Ingalls about prison healthcare policies here in the state. Coming up after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we'll take a look at changes in the U.S. Supreme Court over the years, what led to that decision, plus what it could mean for other past rulings built around the idea of privacy, and what happens now at the state level in Wisconsin and all over the country. You can follow recent reporting on the impact of the Roe v. Wade decision over at WPR.org/news, and there are ways to leave your comments on the issue, how it affects you while you're there. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.